Hi, I'm Steve Clements, and I have a question. Does President Joe Biden have a strategy for the Middle East? And if so, what is it? Let's get to the bottom line. President Joe Biden made his first trip to the Middle East, visiting Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the occupied Palestinian territories. For decades, the region's really been under firm American control. But more recently, China and Russia have become more present and present throughout the region in many Middle Eastern and North African countries, as America's own engagement seems to slowly fade. So what are the results of his four-day visit to the region, and what can we expect on issues ranging from a deal with Iran on nuclear weapons to the prospects of a Palestinian-Israeli peace deal? Today we're talking with Stephen Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of False Dawn: Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. Stephen, it's great to be with you, and I want to play for you a short soundbite of President Biden on this trip. Let's listen to the president.
We will not walk away and leave a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran. We'll seek to build on this moment with active, principled American leadership.
And then at the end of this, the president says, and the United States is not going anywhere. Now, typically, when somebody is making a big declaration that they're not going anywhere, that usually means that there's fears that they are leaving. Well, what's going on with the U.S. in the region?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And I think that the Biden administration really hasn't decided what its posture is in the Middle East after now 18 months in office. You'll recall that when Biden first took the oath of office, there was lots of discussion, including from senior members of his administration, about de-emphasizing the Middle East. Secretary of State Tony Blinken talked about spending more time on other regions in the world and that the Middle East had taken up a lot of resources of the United States of the previous 20 years. What they didn't anticipate was that there were going to be geopolitical and domestic political shocks that were going to drive President Biden back to the Middle East. And his visit to Saudi Arabia in particular had everything to do with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the spike in oil prices and thus the spike in gasoline prices for American consumers at the pump. First, the administration came in saying that the Middle East isn't so important. Now it's saying it is important and we're going to stay. I think what the actors in the region, the Qataris, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Israelis, the Egyptians, they want more than just words. They want proof. They want actions that the United States actually is going to stay and is going to be an anchor of stability and security in the region. Right now, as a result of the president's visit, they don't seem convinced.
Look, I think you and I have been at this now for decades. I've been reading Stephen Cook's books and Council on Foreign Relations papers.
Well, thank you very much.
And I think that the sense I have is that when America wanted to do something in the Middle East, that the big anchor nations in that region largely fell into line. Today, it feels as if, you know, that whole kind of quid pro quo, even the transactions, are up for grabs, that Saudi Arabia is looking as much to China and Russia to hedge its bets against the United States. Are the big stakeholder countries you've written about, like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia, the other, you know, the main weather vanes in the Middle East, looking at the U.S. as the great power in the way they did two decades ago?
Definitely not. Let's keep in mind that between the defeat of Saddam Hussein's forces after the invasion of Kuwait in 1990 and 1991, and then 6 months later to the fall of the Soviet Union, up until very recently, the United States was the only major external power in the Middle East. It could drive events in the region. The Saudis, the Egyptians, even the Israelis didn't really have another option. Suddenly, over the course of the last 5 years, you have a return of the Russians to the region, and you have increasing investment on the part of the Chinese and an increasing Chinese presence in the region. Way back in the 1990s, the Chinese were barely even present. Now they are major, major actors in the region. And the Saudis, Egyptians, Israelis, and Emiratis look at the Chinese and say, hey, there's a lot of opportunity here. We're not entirely convinced that the United States is going to play that role that it once did. And we want to have the Russians and the Chinese at the table so that as a result of the president's visit, the Saudis didn't say, OK, we're going to open the spigot and let the oil flow. They said, look, we have an agreement with the Russians through OPEC Plus, and market conditions will demand how much oil we put on the market. That's very different from the kinds of things that we've seen from the Saudis in the past.
So it's a remarkable thing to think about Russians in the region, to think about Russian troops in Libya, Russian advisors in Egypt. Now, I knew there were always Russian activities in Syria, but there were sort of big limits to where they could go. What's Russia's grand strategy in the Middle East?
Well, Russia is not necessarily interested in the Middle East because of the Middle East, per se. What Russian President Vladimir Putin is after is to weaken the United States and the West. And the Middle East is adjacent to Europe, and the United States has been the major actor in the region. So by intervening in Syria and rescuing Bashar al-Assad, he made an impression on other leaders in the region, in contrast to the way in which they viewed President Obama's actions when there was an uprising in Egypt, in which after just a few days, the president of the United States started talking about America's 30-year ally in Egypt about a transition from power for Hosni Mubarak. That difference, whether they supported Assad or not, made an impression on the leaders of the major powers in the region that the Russians were competent, non-ideological, and making a play for leadership in the region. That undoubtedly, those actions made the Russians seem a more attractive option than the United States. And suddenly the Russians are selling more weaponry to the Egyptians than they have since the early 1970s. The Saudis have struck a much better relationship with the Russians ever since. Russia is there to stay, and it is using its position not only to kind of elbow out or outmaneuver the United States, although the Russians hardly have the same kind of power as the United States, but also by its presence in North Africa, specifically in Libya, it poses a threat to Europe. It's able to sow distrust and concern and division between European countries as well as between the United States and its European allies.
You were one of the most, I think, prescient, but also just brilliant writers about the Arab Spring and Egypt, what came out of that movement. I'm just interested in what is the state of America's democracy efforts in the region. My sense is that a lot of people who stood up for their rights, their values, to sort of change their course of their governments, felt abandoned by the United States, that we were good at offering promises and rah-rah support about democracy, but at the end of the day, we're missing in action. Tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, no, we're not missing in action. I think that the changes that had happened in the Arab world were truly inspiring. But when the United States stepped up to help, there was only really so much that the United States could do. Changing these societies, changing the political parameters in these countries was really up to the people within these countries. As I point out in my book, False Dawn, those people who rose up for demanding rights and democracy, they were up against very, very powerful forces who were determined not to allow them to succeed. It was very little that the United States could do in order to prevent that from happening. All that being said, ever since President Trump came to office, the United States has evinced very, very little official interest in supporting those voices around the region that want to live in more democratic and open countries. President Biden spoke very forcefully about American values during his campaign in the early stages of his administration, but it's been mostly rhetorical. The administration has done precious little on the question, even of just basic human rights. If you look at the repression that people are forced to endure around the region and how basically silent this administration has been, I think the calculation has been there's really not that much
we can do about it. Well, this is why so many people were frustrated with the Saudi trip, because it was very clear that President Biden did not want to do what President Trump did and make Saudi Arabia his first visit outside the country and to go and not address human rights issues. And so he ended up going. There were, you know, a lot of Photoshop pictures of, you know, President Biden sitting there with a gas can in hand.
Right.
But when he brought up Jamal Khashoggi and his murder, as we know by agents of the Saudi government and according to our CIA, at the direct instruction of Mohammed bin Salman, and others basically said, hey, are you, this is ridiculous. Look at Abu Ghraib. Look at your record in human rights in the region. And so where is that? Is that visual, which, I mean, we used to talk about the importance of Abu Ghraib and how it was going to be a terrorism recruiter and it would undermine the American brand and credibility on these issues. Is that still something in the minds of many in the Arab world that it doesn't give us standing to talk about human rights?
We don't have a lot of standing to talk about human rights, not only because of Abu Ghraib, but because of the questions we have here in the United States about the status of our own democracy. Mm. There's a sense that we need to get
This is like January 6th.
January 6th,
you know,
exactly.
The toxicity in this country.
The toxicity, the polarization, the questions about the integrity of our elections are things that observers from other parts of the world, and in particular in the Middle East, are watching and find it disturbing that the United States would lecture them about human rights and democracy and change when the United States hasn't gotten its own house in order. That is really hampering our ability, even if the administration was interested in this issue. But I will tell you that from the very beginning, President Biden painted himself into a corner that was very hard for him to get out of, because there was always going to be a time where he was going to need Saudi Arabia. And it was important for him to speak out about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But by saying, I won't deal with Mohammed bin Salman, by saying, we are not going to sell weapons to the Saudis no matter what, by basically closing off avenues of dialogue with the Saudis, we pushed the Saudis away. And then at a moment of need, the Saudis were able to make the president of the United States look quite weak. And that he did look quite weak when he showed up in Riyadh for those meetings with the crown prince and other Saudi officials, who didn't, in the end, do what the president had wanted them to do, take accountability for the human rights record, pump more oil, and slowly move away from the Russians and the Chinese. None of those things have happened.
I mean, it's remarkable in this trip that President Biden's goal of lining up allies against the Russian invasion of a sovereign nation, its territory in Ukraine, he basically came back with nothing. I kept thinking, well, maybe it's going to come out and maybe in 1 or 2 weeks, so it doesn't look as reactive to President Biden.
That's right.
But virtually nothing has happened in terms of lining that up. Has this got to be one of the most ineffective trips by a U.S. president to a region trying to get, you know, allies to support us?
Well, it does seem to be that it has all been one way, that the United States has essentially compromised its principles. The United States is selling Patriot missile batteries to the Saudis, but the Saudis are not upholding their end of whatever deal that was struck in Riyadh. When it came time on August 3rd, we're at the OPEC Plus meetings, the Saudis said, we're going to release, what, 100,000 more barrels of oil, minuscule amount. We'll see what happens in the fall. But it does not seem that the Saudis are willing to consider the president's position, let's say, diplomatically.
Well, look, this is a little bit of an unfair question because you've already said there is no coherent Biden strategy toward the Middle East. But if there were a coherent Biden strategy toward the Middle East, how important is Israel-Palestine to that? Because Israel-Palestine is a feature of the region, just like Iran's a feature of the region. There are these issues in the region. I can't tell. I mean, the Senator Biden I knew, the Vice President Biden I knew, would never think of not talking about occupied territories and settlements. But you didn't hear much of that when he went to Israel. And so are we bypassing that or just putting it on hold to basically, where would it fit if there was a, you know, Stephen Cook coherent strategy in the Middle East? Where would Israel-Palestine be?
Well, let's just start with the fact that the president's goals in the Middle East have been quite limited. Get back into the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal,
yeah,
which may happen, and to get the Saudis out of Yemen, full stop. I think when it came to Palestine and Israel, the president did go to Bethlehem. He did meet with Mahmoud Abbas. Of course, the timing was terrible. This was after the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh, your colleague.
Right.
And the United States sort of weaselly got out of saying, well, she was murdered by Israeli fire, but it was unintentional. And that really satisfied no one. I think when the president was the vice president, he oversaw negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians and came to the conclusion, despite his long history of supporting a two-state solution, although he's long been a staunch supporter of Israel, I think he came to the conclusion that these negotiations weren't going anywhere and that he didn't want to invest his efforts in a two-state solution, given the myriad problems that he has on his plate. But, of course, you know, there has been a lot of progress in Israel and its neighbors over the course of the last 2 years.
Well,
now.
I want to ask you about that, the Abraham Accords.
There's been a lot of progress.
And you never hear the administration talk about the Abraham Accords.
Right, except for the fact that you still have this central problem that is going to continue to be a source of instability and source of, importantly, societal opposition to these agreements between governments to normalize relations with Israel. In the end, it may not matter, but at the same time, it doesn't help the region that this conflict remains unresolved, and in fact, maybe unresolvable at this point.
So you can have a coherent Middle East strategy and sort of contain the Israel-Palestine dimension of it, is what I'm hearing you say.
Well, that's what I think the Trump administration believed, and I think by default, that's what the Biden administration believed. I think that the second there's some explosion of violence, and I don't mean a four-day war between Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the IDF. I mean, you know, societal unrest in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, people will start speaking differently about it. But until then, I think people have convinced themselves that there can be a lot of progress in the region without really addressing the Palestinian problem.
Well, talk to me a minute about the Abraham Accords, because I think for most people who aren't following this region every day, the Abraham Accords sound like this construct. It's something that was planted. They don't know if there's any fruit from it. How's it going? Who's in it? Is it going to expand? Have relations genuinely changed between, say, the UAE and Israel? Are the Saudis going to line up? Tell us a little bit about that world.
Let me just start by way of anecdote. In March, I was in Dubai, in Abu Dhabi, and I could hear the sing-song of Hebrew everywhere I turned, whether it was in the hotel elevator, in a mall, or wherever I was going. I ran into Israelis. And then I got on a plane. I got on an El Al, the Israeli airline in Dubai, flew over Saudi territory and landed in Tel Aviv. In my childhood, we're talking decades, we've both been dealing with these issues in decades. I never thought that that would ever happen. It was rather extraordinary. So there has been progress. There's a lot of tourism. It's mostly in one direction. There's been a lot of link-ups of business concerns, a lot of security cooperation, which was already happening before the Abraham Accords. The Indian government now wants in on the Abraham Accords. So there has been progress. The question is, will it go beyond the current signatories? Will it go beyond the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco? I don't even put Sudan really in that category, given the instability in Sudan and not really knowing what's going on there. And the big issue is, what are the Saudis going to do? Now, they took a modest step when the president was in Riyadh. They are going to allow Israeli airliners traveling east to India, to Asia, to traverse Saudi airspace. But it strikes me that with all of the kind of speculation about the Saudis being next, it's a much different context for the Saudis to normalize relations with the Israelis without a final resolution to the Palestinian problem than it is for example, the Bahrainis or the Emiratis.
I hate to be sectarian because it's not in my nature, but is this becoming a Sunni league of interest with Israel versus Shia standouts? Is this another proxy for the Iran-Saudi conflict, which is also an Iran-Western conflict? And would just love to know from you, as we sit what I think is on the precipice of a possible return to the JCPOA, at least that's the way things are looking right now, how does that either stir things up more or actually begin to a different track for stabilizing?
I do think it's, you know, you do hate to be sectarian because you don't want to reduce things to, you know,
but
politics.
There's an element there.
But there's definitely an element there. Look, what initially drove Saudi, Emirati, Bahraini, Israeli relations that have been under the table on the security front, you know, in some dark room in a basement in Amman, was the threat of Iran that they all perceived. And, importantly, going back to what we were previously talking about, the sense that the United States was not committed to their security and stability, particularly with regard to Iran. That the United States was off on this idea that you could have a nuclear deal with the Iranians and this would begin a process of the Iranians coming into the region and sharing the region and so on and so forth. They were responding really to a lot of that kind of thinking. But, of course, there are a lot of other Arab states or Sunni majority Arab states who are opposed to the Abraham Accords because of the Palestinian issue. Who's going to win out here? Are the benefits of normalization without settling the Palestinian conflict, are they going to outweigh the opposition to it, or the other way around? So far, the Saudis are making it clear that those benefits will not outweigh the importance of the Palestinian issue, at least for Saudi Arabia.
Okay, I know many people consult with you. What is the state of the JCPOA? And I guess the obvious question is, you know, one of the Iranian concerns, which they publicly expressed, is how do we have any, you know, understanding of solvency of this if you bring in one president who wants it and the next president comes in and says dismantle it? Because, I mean, the truth be told, the parties that did not live up to the agreement were the United States, not the Iranians.
That's right.
We all know that. We violated the deal that we did with them, not the Iranians.
So in that case,
how do you put that back together in any way that'll survive 2024 and whoever comes out the other end?
Well, that's right. And, you know, the Iranians are not alone in this. If you talk to the Saudis, you talk to the Emiratis, you talk to the Israelis, you talk to Egyptians, they're very, very concerned about these 180-degree swings in American foreign policy. Is it the JCPOA? Is it not the JCPOA? Are we important? Are we not important? Is oil important? Is oil not important? I think when it comes, though, specifically to the JCPOA, first of all, let me just put out on the table, I'm getting very tired of trying to spitball this. Mm. You know, those who know really aren't talking.
Right.
I think what we know is that the State Department has said we're close, but there are a lot of hang-ups that continue. And one of them is what you point out, is that the Iranians need some assurance that
we've apparently dropped one of the Republican won't be elected and then breached
the deal once again.
Let me ask you finally about China and China's grand strategy in the region. China seems to be in every region in the world. It seems to, with Belt and Road Initiative, but, you know, debt relations, you know, debt deals that it has around the world. China seems to be present in the way the United States used to be present around the world in the 1950s. So as you've kind of dealt with these various countries, is China as big a factor as I sort of feel it is?
Well, it's certainly the single largest investor in the region, but that doesn't make the Middle East unique. It's the single largest investor in almost every other region of the world, with perhaps the exception of North America, but it even could be, it's significant in North America as well. I think, you know, we're talking ourselves into a sort of Cold War 2.0. You're here in Washington, I'm here in Washington, a lot of discourse about the Chinese threat. I don't actually see it so much in the Middle East. Yes, the Chinese are investing, they want relations, but they don't want to get wrapped around the axle in the way that the United States has in the politics and security of the region. They want to benefit from the security that the United States provides, and they can have relations with all the important countries of the region to serve their interests.
Right.
So, yes, China is a rising power with a lot of ambition. But in the Middle East, as of yet, they're not seeking to challenge U.S. position. They're seeking to extract from the region what they can to pursue their economic goals, which is the continued rise of China throughout this century.
Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for the Middle East and North Africa at the Council on Foreign Relations, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? The Middle East is full of both promise and of danger. The legacy of colonialism, superpower proxy wars, and rivalries between leaders make the region one that struggles with its place in the world. For things to change, we need to see things like the Palestine-Israel standoff being resolved, or relations with Iran normalizing with the rest of the world. But neither of those things have happened for decades. How would we actually know if there's progress? When social and political visionaries in the Middle East rise and rebuff Russia, China, and the U.S. at their efforts at control and show that there's a better way forward for their citizens, then we'd know. That's not to say that the great powers won't be around. They will be. And both the U.S. and China both have a lot to offer. But as long as these powers see the region only through a military sales lens, or as a security threat, or as a gas station, and not for their people, their talent, and the consequence of their region beyond oil and weapons, they're going to get it wrong. And their strategies for the Middle East, like that of the United States today, are going to fail. And that's the bottom line.